Okay, so another night. You survived. I guess we'll take the questions first and see what happens. Okay, dear Venerable Kemawaro, can you please explain again how to identify the will, the doer in meditation practice versus the natural allowing of the watcher? Thank you. Good question. The doer in the meditation practice comes in many different guises, but mostly in the planning, the thinking. A lot of the doer comes from, you know, thinking about the past, what happened early in the week, early in the day, the noise around you, and also the future, planning, you know, reaching forward, but also any kind of wanting or craving. It's all different levels of doing. The watcher is this kind of the knower is what we're trying to cultivate in meditation. This thing that just watches but stays in the middle, doesn't get involved in the stories that your mind is telling you, and the kind of the dialogue that you talk to yourself, you say to yourself when you're sitting there meditating. It just knows that this is happening without getting involved, but also without trying to push it away. Okay? It's a fine thing, because a lot of times you've gone to a couple of meditation retreats, gone to a couple of the talks at Dhammaloka, and you think, oh, thinking, very bad, very bad. I'm trying to get rid of it. I shouldn't be thinking. But that's more doing, unfortunately. The thing is to make peace, right? The ideal is just to be and to watch that. But then having said that, it's also normal. We're just compulsive doers, and we can't help it because of our conditioning. So just to recognize that and kind of pull back gently and say, okay, I'm just going to watch. Whatever comes into my mind is fine. Okay, so that's the distinction between the doer and the watcher. Is that clear? Any more questions or comments? Yes?
You mentioned noise as part of the doer.
Noise.
Yeah.
The noise is not part of the doer, it's the reaction to the noise that's the doer. So, you know, why can't that guy sitting next to me stop moving? That's the doer. Yeah. Why can't she wear, you know, more quiet clothing? Why is her clothing so noisy? That's the doer. Yeah. But just, and I can talk more about this later. But yes, noise is part of the meditation package. That's what you signed up for when you signed up for meditation retreat. There's always one noisy one, very, very loud one. One person moves all the time, every single retreat. So get used to it. Well, that's the thing. Just kind of watching you. Okay, you know, here he comes again. Yes. Right. Right. Yeah. Questions or comments? Yes. Yeah, well, first is to know that, you know, whatever peace and stillness that we have here is conditioned upon, you know, a quiet environment, people who are relatively restrained, and you know, and so that all that is here. And once we move away from that, we have to expect to be more interactions, more noise, and more reactions from that. So just to know that it's also normal when you go out, it's going to be a certain amount of irritations, amount of planning and thinking that you have to do. But you can always say, okay, I'm just going to, this is what happens in the life, but I'm just going to still try to exercise as much awareness as I can. But also knowing full well that, you know, it's not going to be as clear as it is here when you don't have to decide anything, every day, you know, someone, you know, you come out to breakfast and the meal is all ready, you come out to lunch, it's ready, there's no thinking involved. So obviously much more peaceful. But it's very, you know, like I said, it's dependent on causes and conditions here. When you go outside, you've got three kids to look after, you've got, you know, jobs, working with other people, it's going to be much more noisier. But when you cultivate this watcher, you can always go kind of pull back and say, okay, I'm just going to watch what's happening. Yeah? But it's not going to be as easy, obviously. Okay. And we'll talk more about how to incorporate your practice into the lay life towards the end of the retreat as well. Yeah? Okay. Any more questions or comments? Okay, moving on. Am I okay in assuming that practicing being in the present moment by walking and enjoying nature is a positive thing to do in between sitting and walking meditation? Yes. That is part of being present in the moment, you know, in the present moment. When you're enjoying things, you're here. And I recommend that, you know, for people who are new to meditation to do lots of that. You don't have to sit in the room and sweat it out. That's not the point. You can enjoy yourself. And once meditation starts to take off, become more peaceful, then you'll sit longer and longer naturally without having this kind of, you know, ideal that I should be sitting whatever 4, 5, 6, 8 hours a day because I'm on a retreat. But when the mind's still, you know, sitting happens naturally. So to kind of be, you know, be with that. First few days, or when you're not used to sitting so long, yeah, it takes lots of walk. You know, have a sit in the veranda, enjoy the nice views as here, enjoy the peace and surrounding. And then, like I said, in the day one, peace will start to permeate through your body and your mind. Okay? It's not something we can force. If you can force your meditation or force the mind to become still, then we'll all be enlightened because we're very, very good at forcing. Exercising our willpower. But it's not that easy, unfortunately. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay. And yes, you also are free, absolutely free to enjoy the food. You don't have to feel guilty about that as well. Enjoy your cup of tea, enjoy the fruits, the desserts, because that helps you to be in the present moment. And also happiness and happy mind is a concentrated mind. The Buddha said that over and over again. Happy mind is a concentrated mind. Okay? Yeah, but there are obviously very levels of happiness. Once you start with happiness of the sense world, you can move from there. But you're miserable, unhappy, aching, hurting, and it's very hard to move on to get peaceful meditation. Counting the breath seems contrived to me. It's like I'm doing an activity, so busy counting, keeping track. It doesn't feel like I'm meditating. I can get lost in tranquility with a mantra. Am I doing the counting wrong? Yes, with anything, it is a technique. And it's a technique just to... some people find it more useful because if you're counting, then it helps you to ground, you know, to ground the mind in the present moment. One, one, two, two, three, three. And some people are inclined that way. It can be quite useful. But other people, with anything, it's just a technique. Some people get really caught up in it and say, you know, how many rounds can I do? You know, whatever. And then they become very tense. So the thing with meditation is always to watch that. After your meditation session, you're more relaxed, at peace, or are you more anxious, tight, tense? And if you are more, you know, tense, then reflect on what am I doing that is not right? What am I doing? Okay, so there's a purpose to all this meditation. It's not just a technique in itself. You know, we have to be practicing letting go, practicing surrendering, with awake, aware, and with clarity. Okay, it's not something we can zone out and then be, oh, oops, I'm enlightened. There we go. Not that easy. Any other questions or comments?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. I'm going to repeat this. I was asked to repeat this for the people in the back as well as for the recording. The question is that when you're just watching something unpleasant arising, so tension comes up, right? And it doesn't mean, it necessarily means it's a bad thing, or that means that you're doing it wrong. And it could be true. There are times, you know, with meditation, it's not always a happy experience because we carry about certain emotional dramas, certain things in our mind. And when we're peaceful, these things tend to float up into the surface and, you know, make you more uncomfortable, feeling, yeah. So that tension may arise as well from time to time. But if it happens all the time, then you think, okay, wait a minute, something's wrong. But generally it's true. From time to time, also expect that unpleasant memories that we sometimes tend to repress or suppress, that's why we're running, you know, from one sense experience to the next. You know, one of the Thai meditation masters, when they went to the States, he says, yeah, Americans are kind of drunk on sense impingement, sense contact. We're running, you know, always on the phone, internet, talking to our friends, moving around. And a lot of it is just this, you know, perpetual movement away from suffering. We stand still and we're, oh, something's happening, something's wrong, I don't like it. So we move towards it. But that in itself is a lot of suffering. So, and yeah. So from time to time, when we are still, these kind of unpleasant emotional states and memories may surface. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. Because that's how we get to purify our mind from these, you know, negative emotional states. Allow them to come to the surface, to be aware of them, and then also allow them to pass away when they're ready. Yeah. Thank you for the question. Yeah. Any more comments? Okay. When I'm walking, I feel as if I'm starting staring at the carpet to some extent, and also have a bit of tightness in my head. Please comment on how this may affect my meditation and how I may respond to it. Yeah, with the when you're walking meditation, the gaze in front of you, about 2 meters, it's more of a soft gaze. You're not looking for, you know, anything in particular, just making sure you're not stepping on things that may cross your path or tripping on things. So it's just kind of a soft focus, 2 meters ahead, but trying to keep your neck fairly straight. That way you're not walking too much. You might put, you know, if you're leaning forward too much, you might put some pressure on it and becomes a bit sore. So keep your neck fairly straight, soft focus, 2 meters ahead, and then start to walk. And but even before that, you're experiencing some tightness, then just stand still first. And then just kind of, you know, trying to relax your body as much as you can. Relax your shoulder, feet, your hip, your arms. And just, you know, okay, this is something enjoyable to do. And walk as naturally as you can. And see if that helps. Any questions or comments, clarifications regarding this? There is mindfulness we have to be keeping track of, but it's more of a natural thing. And if it doesn't happen in the beginning, don't worry about it. Just kind of go through the motion, walk backwards and forwards, and, you know, be at ease. And then mindfulness increases. Sometimes we bring too much tensions and focus until we focus too hard. Mindfulness is much a softer focus. Dear Ajahn, what are the names of the monks sitting beside you, and why did they choose to walk the spiritual life? Oh, very good. I was thinking, you know, I should talk about these guys or have them talk about themselves. Perhaps they can each take turn and share to the audience a little about themselves. Ah, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
We'll start with the
unflappable Venerable Santuti,
the happiest monk in Bodhinyana.
My name is Venerable Santuti, And the monk sitting beside me is Venerable Chunda, and the one sitting at the end is Venerable Buddharakita. The reason why I chose to walk this spiritual life is I guess when I was a younger man, I was living life like everybody else, and things weren't going so right. There was a bit of suffering in my life, so I decided to do something about it. And what I did was I got in contact with I spoke to my mom, and then she got in contact with some of her friends who were Buddhist, and then they sort of introduced me to the Dhammaloka Center in Nolimara. And from there, that's when I learned how to meditate. And meditation is the reason why I decided to walk this path. because as a layman, when I was practicing it, it gave me a lot of peace in my life. Not a lot, but enough to make me get a little bit more interested in the practice. And at that time in my life, I was a fairly young man, so I decided that I'll give a monastic life a shot. Because at that time, I wasn't really doing much. I was working, but I wasn't really into work, and I stopped working. That's why I became a monk, because I didn't want to work. So I came into monastic life, and from there I basically fell in love with meditation. And till this day, I'm still learning how to meditate. My meditation is good at times. Sometimes it's not so good, but it's something that's worth doing. Even though it may take a long time to get to where you want to get, it's worth the walk. It's actually a nice walk if you can do it properly. So it's like walking through a beautiful place. You can just take your time and enjoy the scenery. And meditation can be like that. You're just walking through this path that the Buddha taught, you know, the Eightfold Path. And it's a really nice walk if you can just take your time and appreciate what the Buddha taught. So, yeah, that's all I've got to say.
Hi, my name is Venerable Chunda. My English is not the best, so it might be a bit broken. Okay, might be a long story. I'll try and make it short. The reason why I become a monk is I've been practicing Buddhism for 10 years, and I decided, okay, this is something that I must do. The reason why is because with the Buddhist practice, is trying to call. When I was working in the mines at the time, and I had a lot of like wandering thoughts. So I'll work hard during the day. When I go back home, then my mind is like all over the place. So I needed a way to calm my mind down. So when I came across Buddhism and I read the Four Noble Truths, straight away it makes sense. Okay, so I understand the cause of suffering. Okay, so, and I read the five precepts. I go, oh, okay, so it's not too bad. So I guess I was a Buddhist in my past life, because everything makes sense. Okay, so I put a lot of effort to understand the third noble truth and the fourth noble truth. The cause of happiness. So when I started doing meditation and trying to purify my mind with practicing loving kindness and to develop the pure mind, as I practice meditation and develop the pure mind, I become more happier and more calm in my mind. And so I reached a state I was so peaceful and I was so happy that I never felt this happiness before in my whole life. So I realized that Buddhism is to look deep into one's heart and mind and see all the problem. And I realized all the problem was not the world, was in my heart, not seeing things clearly. So as I saw myself more clearly, then I start to see all the other problems in the world and why people behave the way they behave. And it was due to craving, always wanting things. But there's no, you can never get any happiness in the world because it's never ending. And the more you look, the more you see that cravings, all the cravings will not stop. It's when you let go, when you let go, then you find that no more happier. And just accept things for the way they are. Because I work so hard as a lay person, and I try my best to help other people. But at the end of the day, I find that it's just endless. There's no end to it. So meditation is to help me to go back and give my mind a rest. So if I rest my mind, then I find that's where I find true happiness and true peace. It's in the calm, peaceful mind. So I find that meditation is to allow yourself to go back and rest in a state of calm and peace. Then when you rest in that calm and peace, you find inner happiness from the practice of Beni, Sila, Samadhi, Panyala. So that's everything in a nutshell, from what I understand. Okay, so I'll pass the microphone to Buddharakita.
My name is Buddharakita, and I was born in Ireland, in Tipperary, and it's a very rural place, very far away from the Buddha Dhamma. And I was born in a Christian family and background, and very simple, like farming community. And so when I was growing up, I was always very interested in spirituality, and you know, I was closely associated with some Christian groups. I went to Christian schools, but you know, when I would look into the Christian teachings, I never really found there was always this cause, God, and effect, you know, and that just didn't sort of correlate with my life. Because I always felt that whatever effort that I put into things, that gave the results. You know, if I worked hard for my exams, I got a good result. If I bummed around, I got nothing. So I just couldn't kind of believe in anything. You know, it just seemed to me to be cause and effect. So whenever I would ask about, you know, Christian beliefs and things like that, invariably these people who were Christian preachers or whatever would invariably say I lacked belief. And then eventually I was very interested in meditation, and slowly over time I was fortunate. I had a job in Singapore, and from there I came across some friends, and they brought me closer into meditation. And through Goenka, I also started practicing meditation in a formal way, because there wasn't any teachings that I really came across in Ireland. It's very remote from the Buddha Dhamma. And I was practicing meditation, and it was really helping me to just cool down and not have any strong feelings of hatred in my heart. And working in Asian companies, and that I was working for Asian companies and bosses and stuff. You know, if you blow up in some meeting or something like that, it's really very detrimental, and it just doesn't work. So a lot of the heavy-handed kind of ways that Westerners operate don't really work effectively in Asian communities. And so I really had to learn to modify my behavior a lot. And I really found that meditation was the only way that I could do it. You know, just going in and saying, I'm not going to get angry, or I'm not going to, lose control of myself, isn't a successful strategy. You really got to sort of drain the bog water away from how we react to different situations and difficulties, uncomfortable weather, or long working hours, difficult conditions, high expectations from different people. You know, so there's no way to really resolve these issues that we run into in life just by thinking about it or just by saying, I'm not going to do that. So I found that somehow when I practiced meditation, that these issues seemed to decline. I began to realize that I could watch and observe my feelings and thoughts, and I didn't have to react to them. You know, I don't have to do what my mind sort of thinks. You know, I have a thought arising in my head, you know, tell that person to take a hike. Well, I don't actually have to say that, you know, because you can just watch the thought arise and not do it. And, you know, if you get stressed out about certain things, you can just feel the body is tensing up. And you don't have to, you know, slam the phone down or shout at people. And so I started to learn that I could really watch myself and make choices about how I would, you know, interact with the world. So I wasn't reacting, I was interacting. And I found that my life and my career and my personal life was blooming. So, you know, life became a lot easier. And I thought, well, this is pretty nice. Well, you know, I thought, well, I'm making a lot of money. I have a very successful career. You know, it's easy. Why don't I just try just practicing a bit more sort of, shall we say, semi-professionally and just give a bit more time to it and see where that brings me. I can always pick up a job again later on. And, you know, so I've been doing that with the last 6 years. It's just kind of rolled on and on and on. And somehow I've always found the support to keep going, and not just the external support of, you know, people who support my practice and so forth, but also the internal support has arisen as well, where I'm continuously interested. And, you know, in my career, and I worked in very, very sophisticated technology and stuff like that. It was very interesting. You know, it's very fascinating. But there's nothing more fascinating than the mind. You know, I've been to many places in the world. I like meeting different situations and people. But it's absolutely trivial compared to what you can meet in the mind. I've enjoyed wealth in the world, but it is not at all like the wealth in the mind. And it's really inferior if you look into it. So it's just this continuous discovery that brings me into the Dhamma. And, you know, I look forward to, you know, what more and more that I can open my heart to within the Dhamma and experience. And it'll just naturally bring me along wherever it's going. So that's why I'm where I am, wherever that is.
Yes, Sonia?
Please hear your story.
Oh, God. okay. I think it's pretty similar to the other path in the sense that it was the meditation that got me interested. But also, I think in most of the spiritual path, it's very unplanned. Like I said, I grew up in a Catholic family, and not really spiritual, because being an immigrant family, we were taught, you know, to go out there, get your good education, and then turn that into a good job, and then to find success. And there was not much kind of teachings or encouragement to look within, always, you know, to kind of do the external accomplishments. So I was quite happy doing that, working in the finance and in the stock markets. And I was in Thailand, actually. My good karma brought me to Thailand. And I was, you know, hanging out there for a few years. And that's where I had a friend who was also visiting. And from California, where I was from. And there's lots of New Agey spiritual fads at the time. So at the time, Buddhism was the flavor of the month. So he came, showed up, and decided, oh, okay, everybody's interested in Buddhism. So he was, you know, kind of studying that. And luckily, he found a monastery where he can ordain temporarily for 2 weeks. And where he ordained, you know, 2 weeks, brought the camera along, took lots of pictures, see me in my robes, see me walking meditation, doing morning chanting. And so he was in a monastery for 2 weeks, and not being a meditator, it got really boring very quickly, right? Because you can't watch TV, you can't read novels. All you can do is hang around with another monk. So anyway, he wasn't a meditator, so he got really, really bored. So he called me and said, what are you doing this weekend? You better come in here and keep me company. So I'm like, ah. So that's how I came across Buddhism. I kept my friend company. And that's the strange thing is, I must have some good past karma, because luckily the teacher, the monk there, was an Englishman, and he could explain kind of basic concepts of Buddhism, law of karma, in a very simple terms, you know. What goes around comes around, he says. That's the law of karma. You do good things, then good things happen to you. And the converse of that, you do bad things, these things can, you know, come back to haunt you. And for some reason that resonated with myself, because being a Christian, I believe in that there's justice, but I didn't necessarily believe that there's a creator God up there who decides everything. And so I thought, this is impersonal law that happens, you know, irrespective of whether anybody's watching or not. So that made sense. And also the other thing that kind of piqued my curiosity in Buddhism was the meditation. Because the monk who was teaching me meditation, he said, if you're a really good meditator, you can see the future. So being in the finance market, I thought, this is very useful. So I'm very, very diligent next few days. Watch my breath, watch my breath. And he didn't tell me it would take, many, many years and many, many lifetimes. But he got me curious. And also during that time, things kind of came together, because during the time the market was kind of tanking and there wasn't a whole lot to do. So I thought, I'll take off a year to live meditation. And then because, going back to New York or any other stock market, it's always going to be around. So I can take a year off and then come back later. And if I do well, I can come back and use all my samadhi and clean up, right? But then luckily he said, his monastery is in the city, so it's a bit noisy, harder to practice meditation. But he knew of a monastery in the countryside of Bangkok, in Ubon, where they had Westerners, because my Thai wasn't very good, that the medium of language and the medium of instruction was English. And it was a forest monastery, so he said it was very strict. He said it was the Harvard of a forest monastery. And it was the Ajahn Chah tradition, where in Wat Phananachat, where they had lots of foreigners to come and to train. And I did that for a year. And it was true. It was coming from a very fast-paced world and going to monastery. I think the adjustment period was difficult. But something inside just says, just keep on going. And when the year is up, the other significant thing why I kind of stayed as a monk was that meeting the Thai forest masters. Like I said, these people who I was saying the other day, who just kind of had this complete amazing presence to themselves. They're completely just very kind, very soft, but also very sharp, who knew kind of help people. And then just being in the presence of a lot of them, just you feel so completely safe, secure. All the questions that you had, you want to ask them, just suddenly kind of melts away. It didn't matter. And like I said, I was working in kind of, high power position, interviewing a lot of the CEOs and a lot of the politicians, just to get an idea of what happened, how they influenced the stock markets. And so met these kind of, wealthy and powerful people. And they didn't, to me, they were good at some things, but they didn't have this sense of ease, they didn't have this sense of clarity around them that I felt that these masters had. And I said, and to me, looking up, the ladder, I thought I saw a lot more confusion. Because, you know, growing up in an immigrant family, you think, oh, you know, once I get whatever, make a certain amount of money, make extra 5,000 a month or whatever, be happy. And then you make, and then you know, happiness comes with having a big house or a big car, you're guaranteed. And then when you see these people who had these things, and you know, when you can, you know, afford these things, and you look like, you're like, well, I'm not much happier. Yes, having a new car, having, you know, nice clothes, it's nice, but it's not, it doesn't last very long. There's always the next thing to get. And I noticed that you know, having more doesn't necessarily mean more happiness. It just means you crave more. You want the next thing. It's always the thing. And then meeting these teachers who didn't have much, but they were completely at ease and at peace, really made me curious. And also kind of inspiring me to know that these are the beings that, you know, myself, my faith in a way, thinks that they're enlightened in something that's possible still in this day and age, something that, you know, can be done by men and women around the world. The Buddhist teaching is still alive and well, something we can practice. So that's why I started to say, okay, well, maybe I can do this for 5 years and see what happens. And with anything, if you're happy doing what you're doing, at peace, feeling, you know, bringing fulfillment, then why change? And that's why I like this tradition, in the sense that there is no pressure to be ordained for the rest of your life. You're not making a vow to anybody. It's just making a, you know, kind of vow to yourself that just pursue this path for as long as it's worth, and then see what happens. So that's briefly is my spiritual journey. And like Buddha Rakita was saying, yeah, it is. Traveling around, sense pleasure, you know, going to different places, tasting different kind of foods and meeting different cultures. There's something there, obviously, some happiness there, some interest there. But the journey inside the mind is much more fascinating. That, you know, the thing I was like in a forest monastery in Wapananichat, and the daily routine was, you know, very monotonous. You know, you wake up at 4 o'clock this morning chanting, you clean the sala, then you go on alms around and walk through the village. And then, you know, they put food in your bowl. After that, you eat, you clean up. 3 o'clock, you do the chores. And then evening, there's morning chanting. And this routine is over and over again. Every day, you do the same thing. You sit by the same people. And you wear the same clothes. You don't wear any other thing. This is it. And for some reason, I found that is really fascinating, because it cuts away the, you know, deciding what to eat, what to wear, who to talk to, but allows my mind to see that the different emotional states that came across this, you know, the same routine every day. But you can see that, you know, the changes in yourself, because the external is relatively fixed, you can see the internal. And for most of us, most people who aren't in the monastic life, everything's changing so quickly. You know, your external every day changes, so it's hard to get a grasp of you know, the changes inside as well. But once you hold the external relatively constant, you can see so much deeper into reality, deeper into the people around you. You can see, you know, why people behave the way they are, because, you know, against a background that doesn't change very often. So I found that the monastic, you know, kind of form utterly fascinating, because of that stability that allows you to look deeply into not just, you know, why you behave the way you do, but the people around you. Like the Buddha said, if you can understand your own mind, you can understand everybody else's mind, because they're basically the same. Yeah. So that's my spiritual journey. Okay, moving on. If we are anatta, why is it our nature to construct a self that sometimes, if not always, inhibits our meditation? Yes, that's the rub. We make a lot of problems for ourselves. But I think a lot of it is just through conditioning. We grow up, you know, we're brought up in a culture that obviously imputes that there's a self in there, that we do things. You know, this is your body, your mind. You have to do some things to get results. And on a certain level, there is a self, in the sense that, you know, there's my body. I'm in my body, and you're in your body. And you have your eyes looking at me, and I'm looking back. So there is a difference. But I think it's non-self in the sense that we don't control, you know, this body of ours. Just take for instance, right? We don't have full control over it. I can lift my arm, but I cannot decide how fast, you know, the blood moves through my body, how fast my heart beat, or, you know, the digestion process that goes through my, you know, in my body, my stomach, the juices that work automatically on its own. I cannot control whether this body of mine ages or not, whether what feelings come into it. Sometimes there's pain and sometimes there's not. I can change my posture and move a little bit, but there the pain comes back. So there's so much of this in our body that we do not control. So that's why it's non-self in that way. That, you know, these things are born because of the, you know, four elements. From our parents, we get our gene. From the food, nutriment, we grow up. And then the decaying process starts. So it's not self in that way, that we don't control everything. It has a process that it takes, and it goes on. And same with the other kind of mental faculties. We can only influence the way we think or feel from time to time. But a lot of times how we feel, that also gets brought upon us, right? Feelings of happiness and sadness, feeling of brightness and darkness, the states of mind, that also comes from time to time. We're not controlling what we think, right? So that's where kind of the Buddha came up, you know, by recognizing, you know, reality. There is not a self in anything, not physically or mentally. They're brought about by conditions, and when those conditions aren't there no longer, these things fade and, you know, become different. Okay? And inhibits our meditation, and that's the thing. If we do have a sense of self, then we get in there and we control it. Because our sense of self, you know, comes from our delusion. Because we're not enlightened, then we're going to have a sense of self. So a lot of times people say, oh, I shouldn't have a sense of self. That only, you know, comes from, if you're enlightened, then you recognize that there is no self. But before then, we will assume that there's a self in here somewhere. And then we will act from that. The only thing to do is just keep this awareness, okay, you know, the Buddha said there's no self. And that you keep that in mind. But it's only, you know, it's only true knowledge, true wisdom will only arise at the first stage of enlightenment when you are a stream enterer, that you don't have a self. And in terms of meditation, really try to recognize that doer. And try to calm that as much as you will, you can. Try to cultivate the knower, the watcher, the thing that just knows what's happening without getting involved. Or at least to recognize when you're trying to get involved. Because the mind will try to get involved. You know, people start to watch their breath and it says, you know, I hold my breath, it doesn't flow naturally. And it's true. Ajahn Chah was saying, his breathing, you know, happens, the body, you know, does his breathing, you know, 24/7, there's no problem. It goes by itself. But as soon as he starts to watch his breath, it becomes uncomfortable, becomes difficult. And that, by inference, is because we get involved, want to do something about it. So try, you know, once you see that, then try to kind of breathe as naturally as you can and try to kind of move back and you know, get your fingers out of the breathing process. But it's something that we all have to work with because on different levels, because it's natural. Unless you're enlightened, you're going to have a sense of self, and the sense of self will get in there. And trying to control, manipulate the process. And it's that very same craving to control and manipulate things that is getting away of your meditation. And the meditation, when you get into a deep state, it's because you let go of something. You let go of some doing, some wanting, right? So just to know that meditation takes up, you have to understand that you've done some letting go somewhere and try to go back to that place where you feel safe enough, have enough confidence in the Buddha's teaching, or have enough mindfulness to not do. But with anything, it's a gradual process, something that we learn by trial and error over time. Any questions or comments? Yes? The question is it like it's our karma, like we have it now?
No, what I'm saying is that's why we have what we've got. Because it's from our past?
Yes, to a certain extent, you know, karma is like we are the person that we are in terms of our physical appearance, our mental makeup, is because of the past karma that we generated and inclinations. Yeah. So if you find that you're having difficulty meditating, maybe you can reflect that maybe in the past you haven't done enough practice. So that way it's not as easy, or if we react to a situation a certain way, it is, because in the past we have reacted in the same way. Certain tendencies carry forward, so that's also part of karma. Yeah, that's right, to a certain extent. But also by the fact that we're trained and we can change our karma. It's not fate, it's not something that cannot be changed. By bringing awareness in the present moment, you can change the way you react. Questions are, do planets affect us or external circumstances affect our emotional states and how we deal with them? There is, to a certain extent, you know, they do come out of research that I guess full moons affect people other, you know, more than others or high in certain ways. But I think, going back to the Buddhist teaching, our mind is the forerunner, the chief. So that's the biggest influence. Other things can influence if we follow along with them. Sometimes, yeah, you know, like full moons, I feel a lot of energy comes up. So we can work with that as well. So it's also knowing, you know, like when you eat certain kind of food, that also brings up certain things. But just to know that, and you can work with those conditions. Yeah. Doesn't mean that, you know, you cannot change, but you just, okay, you understand how your body works, how your mind works, and then you work with those conditions to incline it towards wholesome states. Yeah, more peace and stillness. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Venerable Kemawaro, can you please explain 4 pairs and 8 persons in the something to the Sangha? Yes, in the chanting we had the 4 pairs, just briefly because it can get very complicated and technical. Basically, it refers to the different stages of enlightenment. There's the stream enterer, which means when you first break through to the Dhamma, which means you are only born 7 more lifetimes maximum. And then you have a once returner, it's the next stage, and you are reborn in the earthly realm of 1 more times. A non-returner means you're reborn in the celestial realm, the heavenly realms, and then you're completely enlightened, and you don't come back anymore. So Buddhism believe, obviously, you come back until you get it right, until you learn about what's happiness, until you learn how to let go, what peace is. And once you learn what, you know, peace is, utter stillness. And you start to let go slowly, slowly, and the mind becomes still. It doesn't crave anymore. And when it stops craving, you stop coming back. So looking around, we're here because we bought the tickets. No one's innocent. We came here because we are back here because we have cravings. And that's why we need to cultivate, to train our mind. Because we won't get out of this round of rebirth unless we learn how to still the mind. To complete. Yeah. So that's briefly the 4 pairs and the 8 kinds. It's the pairs because it's they call practicing to stream enter, and then you receive the fruit. So something, there's an experience that happens, and then you are a stream enter. So the both is kind of, you know, on the way and you're there. On the way and you're there. That's once returner, on the way and you're there, non-returner. On the way, and you're there in terms of the arhant. So that's why it's 4 pairs and 8 kinds of beings. But just the only thing to draw your attention to that. When we bow to the triple gem, I always try to encourage people that we're not really bowing to this lump of metal with a whole bunch of things sticking on it, some shiny things sticking on it. That's not what we're really bowing to. We're bowing to the qualities of the triple gem. So bowing to the Buddha, the teacher, the enlightened ones, that's what we're bowing to. And we're also bowing to our own internal Buddha, our own potential to realize enlightenment in this day and age, in this lifetime. That's what we're bowing to. We're bowing to the Dhamma, it's bound to the truth. We're saying truth is more powerful than I am, more worthy of honor. That's why I lower my head to you, the truth, reality. We don't bow to things as you think they should be. Bow to truth as things that they are, they should be. Things as it is. Not how we want it to be, not how we not want it to be. So that's the second bow. Bowing to truth. Bowing to reality. And the third, the Sangha, is more of a specific Sangha. It's not just myself and the four Venerable, although they're very worthy of Venerable. But it's more of the enlightened sanghas, the one who actually trained their mind and became, purified their minds to become enlightened through the training. And the enlightened ones, they don't have to be in the robes. And during the Buddhist time, there's a certain percentage of people who became a stream enterer, living the household lives. But we're bowing to that sangha who have achieved the results of the practice. And we're also bowing to our own kind of internal aspirations to also, to put forth efforts to practice and to one day also realize the results of the practice. So that's what we're bowing to. It's not an idol, it's not a lump of metal, it's not to be reborn in something, but we're bowing to these kind of qualities of the Buddha. And whatever we pay homage to, we bow to, we bring our mind to, and that's what the mind inclines towards. So about the peace, compassion, and wisdom, then over the years, the mind will incline towards those qualities, right? So that's why we do a lot of bowing, is just to a training of the mind. And while it seems kind of repetitious, it's a very subtle training. And I think something, you can't really know whether it works or not until you do it for 10 or 15 years. Just bowing, every time you see a Buddha statue, you bow. And every time you stand up, bow, sit down, bow. Lots of bowing in the forest traditions. But I think it's a very skillful means to kind of internalize the teaching. Yeah. Any questions or comments? Okay. Dear Bhante, why are chocolates, cheese, and lollies allowable to be taken after 12? Aren't they considered solid foods? Yes, we can answer food questions all day long. There's an old saying. They said that when you are a monk, for the first 5 years, food is the only thing that's on your mind. And then between 5 and 10 years, what do you call it? Dutango, meaning tudong, meaning traveling from one monastery to the next. Because when you finish your training, you can go to different monasteries. So between 5 and 10 years, that's all you're talking about. Oh, this is a really nice monastery over there. Oh, that's a really great monastery over here. And that's all you're talking about. And after that, when you're a senior monk, building, construction projects. Oh, how's your boat? Oh, that looks really nice. How big is this? How much does that cost? Yeah, it's all the same. So, and young monks sit around and find loopholes to consume certain things. Basically, in the Indian system, the Buddha divide food into certain categories. And normal food is rice and meat and vegetables. That's normal food. But he also divided another category called tonics, which are things that can be consumed after 12 because it helps the body. So those things are like butter, ghee, and some sugar to just allow you just to have enough energy to practice, really. They're not something for you to have a full meal on. And so these tonics are, that's what we're eating in the afternoon. Dark chocolate, the chocolate part is considered medicinal that you can use. And the sugar is the tonics. So that's why dark chocolate is allowable, not milk. For some reason, milk is classified as food. And that's why we can't take milk in the afternoon. But soy milk, one, it was invented then, and it's a bit of a loophole. So for some reason, and it's also crushed beans, I think. So it's more like fruit juice. Fruit juice is allowable because it gives you energy. So we classify soy milk as more like juice. So that's why it's allowable. And cheese, nobody knows what cheese is. They don't have it in the time of the Buddha. They have this thing called Nawanitan, and no one really knows exactly what it is. So we said, oh, okay, cheese is close enough. Yes, I don't make the rules. I just follow them. So that's the food rule. There's a few other things that people eat from time to time. But it's usually considered it's because it's medicine or tonics. And that's why people can eat. And it's the same thing. It's more for simplicity. And if we're not working, you know, too hard, eating before 12 is perfectly fine. And you can find that a lot of time our eating instinct is because we're moving around and you see food all the time. So it tells us, oh, you got to eat. But you're in a place where you don't see food and no one's eating in front of you. It's no problem, I find. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Yes, that gets tricky. Basically, we can only eat when it's dawn to noon. So that's the main thing. And if I fly in the afternoon, then don't have to eat the whole time. And sometimes it gets tricky when you cross the international lines and stuff like that. Yeah. And so it gets very complicated. But basically, you have to eat when there's light. And also you have to make sure that it doesn't pass the solar noon, which is when the sun is at its highest. Yeah. Mainly for simplicity, but sometimes when you're traveling in this modern age, it gets a bit complicated as well. And basically, you just can watch the time, yeah. The local time where you're at.
Okay. Sorry, but I'd like to add a comment. I used to skip meals due to working and all this sort of thing, and then it gave me gastric and I burned out my stomach, and then and I actually had to follow the vinaya of eating sweets.
And it was true. And you know, when I first, I had lots of doubts about why can't we eat. Kilos of chocolates, and not, you can't eat a regular banana, so it's a bit silly. But I think the thing they kind of looked around, I was in Thailand at the time, and I looked around, you had lots of monks, and thousands and hundreds of thousands of them, and they lived to a ripe old age of 80, 90, and by just following the same diet that I was about to follow. So, okay, they can do it, I can kind of stick along as well. So that also helped, just living in a large community, saying, oh, everybody's doing it, I can just, go along. Yeah. Okay, Achan, from the Metta Sutra we chant every day, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again in this world. Where are they going? That's right. They're not quite arhants. It says not born again into this world, but they can. In Buddhism, there's different realms, so it can be the Deva realms. So that's where they're at. And it's because they have no sense desires. See, we're born into the five sense world with the body, and we can feel, taste, touch, because we like it, because we're attached to it. So that's why we get reborn back. But once you give up this craving of, enough of the seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, hearing, I don't want it, I had enough of that, then you don't get reborn in this realm anymore. You get reborn in some more refined, kind of existence that you don't have a body. Just have a mind, which, it's hard to get your head around it unless, you meditate. But you have a mind, just a mind, not a body to go along. And that's why they don't come back to this realm, because they don't have any more craving for a body. Okay? So they're quite arahants here, but they're the last stage. What are they doing? Not a whole lot. In a more refined realm of higher existence, their lifespan is infinitely longer than ours. It could be billions and billions of years. And it is because they do less. They just, when you're happy, you don't do anything. So multiply that by a few billion times. You're just kind of there, just, enjoying the bliss of a lot of bliss in meditation. You blink an eye, it's like, oh, 3 billion years is gone. Okay, what's another few billion years? But unfortunately, even those kind of very exalted realm, you're not enlightened. So once you finish that good karma that you built up, you go back to this earth again, and you have to start that over. Yeah, and you can fall further down to the animal realm and to the hell realm, because you've used all the good karma already. So that's what the Buddha said, in the earthly realm, with this equal share of sufferings and happiness, is where we have the wisdom to become enlightened. It's too pleasurable in these heavenly realms that people don't, very difficult to become enlightened to those realms. And like Ajahn Chah-Saro kind of explained it, that it's like in being in a 5-star hotel. You have nice air conditioner, you have the, you know, your big plasma TV. So it's too pleasant. So for you, it's very difficult to meditate, right? But when you go outside, and then, you know, when you go outside and it's hot or something, then you can begin to see all this. You know, there's suffering, so I try to get rid of it. So it kind of gives you a good impulse to look into the suffering and to try to transcend it. So that's why the human realm is the best place to put in practice the Buddha's teaching. Well, because their lifespan is so, you know, long, when they get born up there, if it's one day gone, look down, all their friends are dead already, right, in the heaven realm. So it's very difficult. But they can help, but they don't. They help you in more spiritual pursuits. You can't pray for a lottery, you know, lotto tickets or anything of those things. But when you do something spiritual, perhaps, and there's no guarantee. Yeah. So sometimes Buddhists do pray, and that's what they pray to, these kind of heavenly beings. They don't pray to Buddha because he's not around anymore. But they do put their faith, some traditional Buddhists make offerings to these gods that they think can help them. Well, in the traditional Theravada, we believe that he's the only one that truly gone, extinct. It's like the candle. When the flame is gone, you go to the west, the east, north, south. It went into the heavenly realm. No, it didn't go anywhere. It just went out. Yeah. Yeah, because craving is no more. Craving is the wick that burns it. Yeah. And when that's burnt, it's gone. Extinction. Yeah. Yeah. But it's a happy path. The closer you are, the happier you become. So it's not something that you have to grit your teeth all the way through. You get result. That's what they say. The Dhamma is beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end. Because however you practice, however much you realize it, it brings less suffering to yourself. So always a good kind of way to judge your practice. If you're suffering more, something's wrong. You practice the Buddhist teaching, life should be, you know, easier and easier and happier, naturally. Doesn't mean you have to be happy all the time, but it means you can have the wisdom to, you know, look at life and to act or interact in a skillful way, a way that brings happiness to yourself and the people around you, naturally. Yeah. It's not giving up your own happiness for another person, or, you know, or vice versa. True happiness, true skill, you know, wholesome happiness, usually is a win-win situation, both for yourself and people around you. Any other questions or comments? Yes, all right, more in the back, yes. Hope we shall meet again this life in another realm of life. Thank you. What they're doing, just curious, that's all. Hope we shall meet again, yeah, after this life, in another realm of life. Possibly, hopefully back in earth. Where it's easy to practice. Perhaps you should bring us the forest for a silent walk there. Only a suggestion in a warm afternoon, say 2 to 4. A Dhamma student for 3 years. All right. Okay. Possibly. But I think it's hard to get people to walk along. But certainly you are welcome to do a silent walking meditation around the forest. It's an exceedingly beautiful place, very quiet place, because we're in a valley. So it's, you know, you don't get the noise from the street at all. So yeah, I certainly encourage people to enjoy the nature. It's wholesome, leads to peace and stillness. Dear Venerable, Ajahn Brahm makes the point about retaining a sense of non-self when practicing mindfulness and meditation. This has helped me a lot in my practice, and I was hoping you could speak about how we can retain this sense of non-self in our day-to-day lives so we may live completely without fear. Many thanks. Yeah, non-self is a big topic, but one of the ways you can use non-self to help is to reflect. The reason we have fear is because we are attached to mostly our body, right? Fear of, you know, being hurt, being harmed. It is our attachment. That's why we lock our doors when we go to sleep. We think, you know, somebody will come in the middle of the night or some creature will come in and hurt this body of ours. So just to reflect that a lot of the fear do come from our attachment. And the more we lessen that attachment, then we become less fearful. And like I was saying earlier, yeah, this non-self, this body of ours, because we only kind of lease it for a period of time. And when nature takes it back in terms of illness, in terms of, you know, old age, then there's nothing we can do about it. Well, it's a whole process that kind of we just have to go along with it. And by seeing that as non-self, then we don't suffer unnecessarily. When we do become sick, when we do, you know, become older, things start to fall out, your hair starts to go gray, your energy starts to, you know, get weaker. So, oh, why me? Well, you know, why not? It just happens. It's the natural process. And the more we get our head around it, the more we can age gracefully, right? Instead of, I saw a few years ago this, you know, obviously a cosmetic company in advertising that shows this, you know, lady in her middle age, and it's for skin, you know, skin cream or something, and says, "I know I'm going to age, but I'm going to fight it every step of the way." She's asking for lots of suffering because you cannot fight it. That cream can only last, you know, may look younger. But eventually, she's, you know, things will fall apart and starts to sag. And no amount of, you know, surgery, cream is going to prevent that. So hopefully we're Buddhist. I know I'm going to age, and I'll do it gracefully. That's the way to go. And by seeing that it's non-self, by seeing that we don't have no control, we work with the body. When you have lots of energy, then you do more things. And when your body's weak, then you just kind of, you know, do less. You know, we're not kind of... But it doesn't mean you don't take care of it. You take care of it the best as you can. But you know that no matter how much yoga you do, how much Pilates, you know, you eat, you know, wholesome, organic, non-GM, modified food, you're still going to get old. And you're still going to die. Right? So that's just part of this package. And with knowing that, non-self, that things happen, then, you know, we don't get so disappointed. When we do get older, we don't get disappointed when people around us die accidentally around us. Because, you know, there's no guarantee in life. Not for us and not for anybody else. So just kind of reflecting on these things do help. But they will sink in slowly. And only the enlightened ones will have this perception all the time. If you somebody die on you and you feel disappointed, you feel depressed, it's because we have assumed, you know, missing unjustified expectation that these people around us will live forever. Your parents, no matter how much you love them, your kids, you know, they have their own causes and conditions. Sometimes they live to a ripe old age, and sometimes they don't. But that's just part of life as well. Okay? Questions or comments? Okay, two more questions. This is a fan letter, so I don't have to read this. Okay. Venerable Kemawaro, do we have to know Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Dependent Origination, other suttas, in order to continue meditation? Where do Dhamma knowledge and meditation practice meet? Thanks. Yes, you have to know everything. Else you won't be enlightened. No, it's not true. Ajahn Chah's famous teaching, when you know they had the scholar came and asked him, you know, I did my PhD in Buddhism, I've done the Abhidhamma, all the suttas, and says, you know, what other book should I read? And Ajahn Chah pointed, read this book, your heart. Read your mind. It's the only book you have to know, really. The teaching the suttas, because they are the words of the Buddha, and he was completely enlightened, so they're pretty spectacular. But with anything, it's just a guidebook, right? No matter how many books you read about parrots, you're still not going to know until you go there. And you can, you know, it's the same with Ajahn Chah's famous simile of the mango. You know, no matter how many books you read about the mango, how many pictures you see about it, you know the different types of mangoes, 200 of them, they grow in what areas, what makes them grow, how to tend to them, what little mango trees look like, and what flowers, you know, when they bloom, what the flowers look like. You can write your own books about mango trees. Because all the books you've read, you can, oh yeah, these mango trees are like this. And, you know, there are the red one, the white, you know, the green ones. The green ones you can use for different type of food, and on and on and on. But until you sink your teeth into one, you never know what they taste like. Right? So the books are a good start, but they will never take you to the finish line. And it's not possible. But it is a good start. And for a... But there are certain essential things that you need to know, and that's the Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path. Dependent origination is also helpful. But these things are something for you to contemplate, and then when you have a good meditation, and this is where Dhamma and meditation meet. Once you have a good meditation, when you're really still, and the mind you come out is really bright and powerful, then you picked up these concepts to reflect on it again. And that's where the insight, the major insight happens. A breakthrough, when you truly understand what suffering is. Because suffering is like, you know, cigarettes to a smoker. Everybody tells them, yes, cigarettes is bad for you. It ruins all the parts of your body. It stinks. It smells bad. It's expensive. Is it enough for you to quit? No. It's the same with the truth of suffering. We know there's a certain amount of suffering out there. But deep down somewhere, we still think there's enough pleasure in life. To not have to worry about to not have to look at the suffering, and to not understand it fully. And to understand something fully, then we can let it go. Right? Because we don't understand that we hold on to things. And something I always reflect, one of the verses in the Buddha said, was, you know, what the enlightened one said is happiness, the world said is suffering. And what the enlightened one said is suffering, the world said is happiness. Because it is because of our own delusion that we go after things. You know, we go after relationships, cars, achievements, different experiences, because we think it brings happiness. But in the end, there's lots of stress involved around that. We don't see that. Yes, you know, having a partner, very nice, but there's lots of maintenance involved in having any kind of partner, right? And you don't always get along. You know, a handsome boy or a pretty girl, you know, she or he only lasts 10 or 20 years. After that, you know, it's all downhill, literally. So, and if you're lucky, other times you probably have a big fight over that. And then it's split up. So we have to contemplate these things. There is a price tag in all sense pleasure. And to know that, eventually we can say, okay, yes, it's nice, but, you know, I'm happy by myself. I'm not going to, you know, buy into this ride. But there is happiness, and that's why, you know, people follow it. And sometimes, you know, but also, if you're in the world, then it's okay to enjoy the happiness of the senses. because it's natural. The Buddha said, unless you have other type of happiness to substitute for the happiness of the sense, then most people will go for the happiness of the senses over and over again. So that's why meditation is important, because unless you have the happiness of peace and stillness, then you're not going to trade for the happiness of the sense. But you know something more superior, then okay, you can let other things go. It's like, see a little boy playing with his sandcastle. Yeah, obviously he's very, he's enjoyable to him, and he can play hours and hours building up his sandcastles and playing with it. Or playing with his, fire truck, his toys. But if, as an adult, if you've gone beyond, and you're like, okay, that's interesting. Obviously it's happiness, but it's not something I want to get into. And it's the same with the different levels of happiness. And Buddhism, that's what it's about. Although we do talk about suffering a lot, it's about happiness, the flip side of suffering. It's knowing what true happiness is like. And you strive for that, the happiness of peace. And peace itself is quite happy. And I know it's getting late, so but just to say a few words about meditation and boredom. Right, we come to meditate, and we want the bliss, better than whatever Ajahn Brahm says, this kind of, pizzazz, this kind of, excitement. That's what we want. But actually, peace is the highest happiness, right? The peace of meditation is going to non-doing, non-being. And I think the initial days, people might get, kind of uncomfortable, say, now what do I do? Nothing to do here. Can't watch TV, can't talk, can't eat what I want to eat. This is really, really boring. They always ask me that. Every time my old friends or people who are new to monastery, don't you get bored here? Don't you get lonely? No one to talk to? You sit in your kuti by yourself? And there's a certain amount of boredom that had to happen when I was in the being a monk. But once you get your mind around it, boredom is good. It means you don't have to do anything. Boredom just means the stillness, but that we don't recognize that and we want something else. So a lot of times we have stillness, the silence. We think, oh, it's boring. I've got to go do something. I've got to get something to drink. Think of a new thought because the mind is too still. But just a lot of people to say that, when the mind is bored, it's good. Boring is great. Because you're not doing anything, you're not having to do, think, plan. But the mind is, because it's used to activity, going for sense pleasure and, running after the next thing, next best thing, next big thing. That's what the mind wants to do. Always the next big thing. I'm watching my breath, so I want a beautiful breath. I have a beautiful breath, I want the nimitta. I want the nimitta, I want my jhana. So it's next, next, next. I don't want to be stand still. But meditation, we should have enough wisdom to see, no, here is where I should be. Here, wherever I am, is where you should be. And the mind opens up by itself. You don't have to do anything. The more you sit, the more you hold, embrace the bored state of mind, then slowly it will brighten up. As long as you don't go anywhere. So yes, people think, they come for this excitement and bliss, but no, you're going to be bored out of your brain. Hopefully really bored that you leave yourself behind, that the mind starts to open up by itself. And also, kind of like I said, I warned the people, yes, over the next few days, there's not much happening. And to expect that. To expect there'll be long periods, and you're sitting there just going, oh, never doing this again. Why did I get talked into this? Jim Brown's jokes. No, but once you get over the hump, you get over this kind of mental state that looks at peace as boring, then things become bright, and things become, happier by itself. So that's a few words regarding boredom. Any questions or comments? Getting late, so we'll continue sitting, or you can call it a night.